Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the fact that Wizards of the Coast this week just canceled Sigil, their flagship virtual tabletop for the new edition of D&D, and they laid off all the staff after working on it for years. So what's the state of online play today, and can Wizards ever get their digital shit together? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into it, folks, I will remind you, as always, that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our After Party chat. That's a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server with all our patrons, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier that helps us pay for the production of the show, and we deeply appreciate it, and you'll get an invite to the Discord server. Get that all set up during the course of the show, and maybe about 10 or 15 minutes after the show, we will be there to host our live After Party chat.
We love that. And today, quick hi to the folks that are wrapping up GaryCon today. Hope you had a good time this weekend. And if you want to jump in as you debrief and tell us how GaryCon went in the live video after chat on our Discord, we would love to see you there. Now, Paul, as we talk about the interesting news out of Wizards this week, we should give full disclosure to our viewers that you in the past have worked a little bit on multiple projects as a consultant at Wizards of the Coast. You haven't been there in a while. You have not done any work on this Sigil project, so you're disconnected from that. But there you have in fact done some work in the past at Wizards. Is that correct?
It's true. In my job as a software engineering consultant, I have worked multiple times with them, and so. Yeah, I am still somewhat bound by NDA in a few cases. So there may be, if certain questions come up, I may have to be vague in my answers or prevaricate a little bit, in which case I apologize. But
that's great. And as I told Paul beforehand, I am going to be testing the boundaries of that NDA quite likely, intentionally or unintentionally. I mean, I do that with all of our guests. So that's you should know what that looks like. Now, Paul, I would like to start by reading a quote from Wired Magazine. Is that okay if I do this?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so here's a quote that I found on Wired Magazine. Wizards of the Coast has had a great deal of difficulty delivering on what they have promised. The online software tools have regularly gone months without updates. The online magazines have been up and down in quality. It's unclear what will become of the much-anticipated VTT, which is still in beta testing after years of delay, now that a new edition is underway. It's not hard to imagine that the fans who have been waiting more than 3 years to play their favorite version of D&D online are out of time and thus out of luck. Now, that quote that I just read is from Wired Magazine, written by MJ Harnish in 2012 in regard to the fourth edition virtual tabletop.
Nice. Nice. Well done.
Can you believe that? It is word for word appropriate today in 2025.
Dan, sadly, I can believe it. So I can say this about my past experience working with Wizards of the Coast. I have worked with them on multiple projects as a consultant in different cases, different contracts, different time periods. None of the things I worked on ever shipped. So just let that sink in.
You know, Paul, I will say that so you have a much longer career in computer games than I do. So I had a brief window at a couple of companies, and then I moved into academia myself, and you have much 10 times as much experience as I did at the time now. But I will say that the probably the top thing that irritated me about the industry is working on projects and not having them ship. And you know, my experience of that was maybe like a 5-month project or a 6-month project, and it still kind of burns me today. And obviously you have had to deal with much larger projects with much greater level investments that haven't shipped. And to me, that really irritated me.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a tough one. And you do just have to swallow that. That's, I spent 4 years working on an MMO with hundreds of people and that didn't ship. And I remember at that company working with people who in their entire careers had never shipped a game that just repeatedly it didn't make it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's super rough. I got to say it. There was a time period there, maybe about 10 years ago, where I was looking at my resume and going like, you know what? I got a lot of shipped games on my resume. That's fantastic. That is like really lucky, because I know plenty of people who don't have that, who have the same amount of experience as me, but don't have all these shipped titles. I know I've shipped plenty of things and I've gotten a lot of games out the door and it feels great, but I definitely do not assume that about any project I work on, because I don't know what the percentage of games I've worked on have actually shipped, but it's not as high as one would hope.
Yeah. That's rough. That's rough, man.
Yeah. It's tough. It happens. It is definitely an issue in the industry. It's difficult. It's difficult to hit the finish line. Yeah. It's really interesting because I've worked with plenty of younger game developers who get very excited at the opportunity to start a brand new project, which is also not a super common experience, right? Because oftentimes you're coming in to, you know, get a job at a company and they're already underway, right? They've started working on the thing and you're joining this project a little late, and so you're having to catch up on what exists and then add to it. And so I've worked with plenty of people who are very excited about like, oh, we get to be there at ground zero when the game first, you know, the idea first came out and we're just getting started. And my response to this, that's a nice experience, but you know what's even better? Live operations, which is specifically working on a game that is already publicly available and you are, you know, fixing bugs or adding content or maintaining servers, etc. like that, because that experience is super rare. It's sadly super rare, like just not that many games cross the finish line to the point where you then get to continue to work on them because they are not only have shipped, but were successful enough to warrant continued development.
Interesting. You know, you're reminding me that in the brief time that I was in video games, it was circa end of, I think it was 99 or 2000 or something, where I did interview for the team at Turbine that was the live team for D&D Online at the time. And like a lot of my experiences, I was told that I came in second as the second number two candidate for the position there on D&D Online. I actually haven't had the experience of actually being part of a very large online live game. I mean, where we worked, initially, we had kind of small games that were online that were successful that other people made. So I can see that, though, getting feedback from actual players. That's kind of what you're in it for, right? That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
It's nice. Yeah. Anyway, we could spend the whole time talking about that, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the virtual tabletop from Wizards of the Coast. So I want to
point this out. So our friend Joshua in the chat here, who is also a software professional, points is saying, I would point out that some claim most large software projects fail, not even talking about video games. WotC's not alone in this, which is a true statement. However, I got to point out that specifically Wizards has a really funny, very close carbon copy of this cycle that they've been doing ever since they acquired D&D. So mention a couple beats here. In 2000, they came out with third edition, right? And third edition came with a CD, right? With a disc for the demo version 1.0 character generator, a little taste of the master tools that they're planning, right? And this disc could make first level characters, okay, give you a little taste. And the idea was the master tools would make characters and monsters and treasures and maps and encounters and all kinds of stuff. And as a couple years went forward, they had to massively scale it back. We can't do the mapping. Yep. We can't do the encounters. We can't do this stuff. It was actually a version was released that could make characters of any level. and it was buggy and it crashed and it was a piece of crap and it was canceled. And then fourth edition came out going towards 2010, and they specifically said, we're actually rewriting all the D&D rules specifically to support online play and make that easier for us to implement. And they had a virtual tabletop as part of their D&D insider there. And it was in beta testing and it was produced for a couple of years and and it was buggy and it crashed and it didn't work very well and it was canceled. It was never released. And now, and that was where the Wired article was written around then. And now here we are in 2025, and 2 or 3 years ago, they announced that with the new version of D&D to come out in 2024, a major part of their operations was going to be virtual tabletop. And half of people play D&D online nowadays, coming out of COVID. It's an enormous revenue stream. It's the major thing that is part of our flagship new project, and they've been producing it for about 2 or 3 years. They started playtesting a month ago, to my understanding, and it was buggy, and it was crashing, and it was a piece of shit. And what was reported at Rascal just this past week is that they've laid pretty much everybody off, 90% of the staff. They've officially canceled the project. And once again, a massive online mapping, blah, 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 has done the exact same 2 or 3 year cycle and then gone down in flames. And Wizards keeps doing exactly a carbon copy. It's like you're casting the simulacrum spell over and over again. What piece of damage is in the company that causes them to not learn this lesson?
I don't know. That is a fascinating, especially when you the fact is, Wizards of the Coast has a fairly large digital arm in terms of making things with the D&D IP, right? Video games that are either licensed to other studios or that they're making internally, and they have produced quite a lot of stuff. Plenty of successful CRPGs with the D&D license have come out and been fantastic, right?
Okay.
But if you narrow your gaze to, digital tools for playing the tabletop game, they are just absolutely terrible about it. And so much so that I would say, like, one of the funny things is when D&D Beyond came out, that, of course, was developed by a third party. And one of the most amazing things about that application was that it was simply so good, right? That it worked as as advertised, right? As advertised, absolutely. It was really good, right? I was just talking to Tanya this morning about virtual tabletops in general and how, like, oh, I remember when VTTs, maybe even before virtual tabletops or somewhere around the same time, right? There was this time period where, like, we were really obsessed with electronic surfaces, right? Like, remember the Microsoft Surface, or you had all these things where people were taking monitors and flipping them horizontally to play D&D on, right? And it was this, or using projectors to put images on the tabletop or whatever, this kind of like AR situation of playing D&D, but with a digital, system underneath to do all the map rendering and extra effects and rules adjudication et cetera. And I feel like that kind of faded away. Now maybe the pandemic is a bit to blame for that fad kind of dying suddenly. But the interesting thing is, I feel like I keep hearing about things like that, like these new, like, revolutionary, oh, this is going to totally change the way everyone plays tabletop RPGs. And the one thing that I can say, the one application I'm aware of that really did change how people play RPGs is D&D Beyond. And in a very small, subtle way of just, instead of having a paper character sheet, a lot of people started having tablets and phones and devices to track their character sheet, their fifth edition D&D character sheet, right? It invaded the group that I was playing with at that time period. Yeah. It was just good. And so, like, I have to say, the one move that I saw Wizards of the Coast make that I thought, like, now they're finally getting it, is they bought D&D Beyond. I'm like, yes, they did something good. Yeah. They made a great product. Yeah. You buy them, you incorporate them, you bring them in, and you maintain that. Fantastic. And then, of course, they were like, now we're going to develop our own virtual tabletop from scratch using, video game technology, Unreal 5. And I thought, oh, they're positioned well for this because they do make video games internally. They have people who understand this kind of stuff. And nope, they just dropped the ball completely.
Fascinating. I mean, all the examples, so I went through all their examples of, like, major digital projects that I've seen in the past always had some, you know, going back about 30 years now, have had another production company listed as the developer. And there's been Fluid, and there's been Code Monkey, and there's been something else and something else. There's been Evermore. There's been Dragonbyte, I guess. Is it like how long? Okay, so tell me, as someone who's unaware, like how long has Hasbro had a digital arm that's competent? So apparently they're doing something competently. How long have they had how long has Wizards or Hasbro had some kind of competent something happening in their digital arm?
That's a good question. But I can say at least 10 years at this point. Because I'm drawing strictly on memory of having visited their offices in Seattle somewhere around 2015-ish, give or take, if I remember correctly. Right. I might be getting that wrong. Might have been closer to 2018 or 19, somewhere in that range. But I remember, and, you know, massive, you know, 6-8 story, something like that, building, and just like whole floors devoted to software development going on there. So, like, it was clearly a big deal already by that point.
Interesting.
I don't know how long it took them to get there. Like where was, you know, okay, so they started printing Magic cards in the mid-90s, right? Somewhere between 95 and 2015, they really started sinking their teeth into software development.
Got it.
I don't know when. I don't think I could put my finger on it.
It's interesting. And of course, I guess the other thing we should say at the top of the hour is that Paul and I, we met at a company that was initially pitching to Wizards to make Magic the Gathering Online. And where did we come in on that, Paul? I think number two, I think. and you can see our interview with Peter Atkinson a couple of years ago where I put that question to him. So my other question is, you know,
about it. Still salty. We should have made Magic Online.
Checks out. Yep. So my other question, you know, here's another thing I'm not salty about, is not at a company where I met you, Paul, but at another company where we did racing simulations. We were fairly successful, had, you know, branding, had licensing from NASCAR and IndyCar at one point. And then the company was acquired by a much larger firm, and the new management came in, and they said, "We don't want to change anything you're doing. You are doing great, you're very profitable. We don't want to change anything you're doing." And as a very young, naive game developer in my first job, I believed that. And then a couple months later, we're going to get rid of your entire art department. We're going to get rid of half of the entire company, because our manager on the side also owns a very cheap art company in St. Petersburg. So we're going to have them do all the art instead. So I became very jaded when acquisitions happen, but the first thing they say, largely to stem staffing losses that they don't want, is to say, "We're not going to change anything." And then that has really nothing to do with the decisions they're going to make down the line. So my question is, when a company acquires something like D&D Beyond, whether it's Wizards or otherwise, can they maintain that? Or is it in the cards long term that it's going to degenerate over time? Does that make sense? Gosh. Can they maintain
it? Yeah. Yeah, it depends, frankly, and that's, I don't know. Broad strokes, I'll say I've seen a lot of acquisitions in my career. I'm talking more from the speculation of like video game development, but I've seen plenty. In fact, the company I'm currently working for, I'm a technical director of a video game studio that was acquired by a larger company. So it's all over the place in video games. Inevitably, there is a culture clash, right? That is, there's a cultural issue when one company buys another one. You're lining yourself up for this difficulty, which is, you know, not to say, video game companies shouldn't acquire each other. Like, sure, they should, but just got to be aware that there's going to be this culture clash that's going to happen as the two companies get involved with each other. And generally, my experience has been that the more autonomous the acquired company is allowed to be, the better it usually does.
Yeah. And how would we assess that Wizards does on that aspect? Do they let everybody...
I can only speculate. Okay. I can only speculate. I don't know.
Great. Great. So let me ask, you know, I got one thing I should mention is, you know, we basically predicted this. So Project Sigil, right? We've had prior episodes like a year or two ago, you know, scoping out the current state of virtual tabletops for online role-playing play, you know, talking about Wizards' digital history. And we more or less predicted that this particular project was going to most likely follow the same path as the copious earlier projects that they had. So I feel like it wasn't super surprising, all things considered. So feel free to check in on our prior videos and see if you can confirm that we actually did say that in the past. So this Sigil project, right? So the Sigil project, I think part of it was with the D&D licensing, they had an enormous smash hit with Baldur's Gate 3, right? Right around the time that they announced the VTT. And obviously, again, we're coming out of COVID and a whole lot of play is online. The CEO at the time said that just about half, 50% of D&D games are played on a VTT now. And the other thing they were pointing out was that the revenue from D&D Beyond that was coming in is about half of the D&D profits. So already it's about half of their business there.
Now I don't know that you can necessarily say that those two facts are directly correlated, okay. Right? So like one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is just sort of like general adoption of virtual tabletops and who's using them. Now, I mean, there's no denying that in 2020 it was huge, right? Because it's how some of us clung to rational thought, right? Was we could still go online and play D&D because we're all locked in our houses. So obviously there was a huge burst at that point of virtual tabletop play, right? But I would say if you look at D&D Beyond, what is D&D Beyond, right? Yes, I guess it's got a virtual tabletop or is Sigil now its virtual tabletop? I don't totally understand what's going on there with their VTT, but they have a maps thing, right? A map thing.
That's my understanding. They have a maps thing that some people point to as a VTT, and also not entirely clear what the status is.
Which just goes to show, I think, that like clearly that is not the main thrust of usability of D&D Beyond. Right, I think the major feature benefits of D&D Beyond is one, character management, right? And you can not only just create characters, but you have an interactive character sheet that lets you track all your stats and hyperlinks to rules and all this good stuff, right? And then also, it's a digital distribution of the rules, right? You buy literally buying the rule books in digital format, and again, yes, sure, it's there as a PDF, but also more importantly, it's there as like a searchable indexed database of information, right? So it is actually, there's a lot of tools for navigation, let me put it that way, right? So if you're someone who wants fast, you know, computer-based, navigation
searching.
Of D&D rules.
Yep.
Searching, sure, yep, and hyperlinking, right? Like, okay, this spell causes this status, and I can just click on the status, and it immediately tells me what the hell that means, right? Great, fabulous. Those are like, and so those features, frankly, those features don't necessarily mean online play, right? Like, again, like my experience with D&D Beyond is it invaded my D&D group. We're at the table. Right? Literally at the table, players are playing. The DM's got a laptop open. The players have tablets in front of them. They're using D&D Beyond, but not with a virtual tabletop, with a real physical tabletop. Still using miniatures, still using dice, but just also using D&D Beyond on the side as a you know, as a rules navigation and character sheet management tool.
You know, one thing you're making me think at the kind of speculate is one of the top criticisms I hear about D&D 5th edition 2024, for example, with the player's handbook, is that it takes a ton of flipping around the rules, the book, in order to find the full extent of some particular ruling. So I hear I'm looking at a spell, for example, and just like you said, it refers to a status, and for that I need to flip back to the glossary, which is the place where that status gets defined. Or I'm in the part on encounters or something, and it says, here's a state, I got to flip back to the glossary, and I have to keep flipping back between possibly two or three places. Is there any possibility that if your focus is on an online hyperlink thing, that you lose sight of the physicality of that, that it becomes trivial to just jump around? That's where it came from?
Very likely, I'm sure. And my experience with that, too, is it's not even just one hop, right? It's often like, oh, you know, this spell causes this status, and I go and dig up that status, and that status then refers to this other ruling that I then have to go look in another section of the book, right? Like, and it's, and that is very difficult to deal with in the books. And yeah, I could totally see that, like, if you're hyper-focused on how is this going to work in a digital space, that you may accidentally poorly organize the physical. Yeah, I could see that.
Yep.
So, sorry, just to get back to what I was getting at, though, is that, like, I don't know right now, like, what... It's interesting that they're claiming stats about how many games are run virtually. I'm sure it's still quite a lot. But I also wouldn't be surprised if there's a fair number of people, because I'm included in this. Like, I don't really like to play virtually anymore, right? It was a great boon when I had to, when there was no other choice. But now, right now, if I want to play D&D, I would much rather play it at a table than online. And I know that's not everyone's opinion, and I know opinions, are sure this will vary, but, like, I'm curious, what is the distribution at this point of tabletop, physical tabletop play versus virtual tabletop?
I mean, that was a claim by the CEO, Chris Cox, like less than 2 years ago, I guess, or almost exactly 2 years ago. And I mean, no, I'm not entirely sure.
English,
I guess they could do surveys, I guess.
As my 12th grade English teacher always used to say, consider the source, right? Did he say that, you know, is he releasing that stat because he's trying to promote a specific product?
Yes. Yes. Well, I think it was also trying to assuage stockholders that they knew how to pull out of the revenue decline post COVID. I think was a little part of it.
I was trying, as we were getting ready to have this conversation, I was trying to reacquaint myself again, because I'm a person who would prefer to play in physical space. Like, I am not really up on the latest in VTTs, and I had to go digging and remind myself, because there was a time when I was very interested in it, right? And that was like 2 or 3 years ago, right? And now I'm looking at this list of VTTs, and okay, sure, there's like Roll20, and I remember Fantasy Grounds being a thing. Obviously, we had a friend of the show helped develop, or did develop, D20 Pro, or maybe he developed it entirely on his own. I can't remember if he had a team or not. Anyway, those things all still exist, but also I'm finding things like Owlbear Rodeo and Table Plop. And I'm like, I've never played with any of these. Even Alchemy RPG, I don't think I've personally played with. And the funny thing is, I kept looking on the list for one that I was trying to remember the name of, and it took me a long time, which was Vorpal Board. I remember being very excited about Vorpal Board.
Right.
And I had digging to find it, and it's still there, and I can still log in and play with it. But literally, I can't find any news or any information, any public posting about it made after 2022. Like, all of their social media, all of, like, the Reddit posts about it, I cannot find anything dated post-22. So, what happened to Vorpal Board? Is it just, it's done, and some people use it, or is it in the decline?
Interesting. You know, I think, Paul, you and I think in parallel, we're doing the exact same research this morning, because I also dug up, say, like, where are VTTs these days? And does anybody have any hard numbers on usership or anything like that? Thank you, because, Vorpal Board. We were very excited about that at one point. Saw a couple of people using it. So I think that the big three, my feeling is the big three are Roll20, Fantasy Grounds, and Foundry. Is the impression that I get. And then you've got some people pointing at maybe D&D Beyond Maps, maybe if it counts. Like you said, Owlbear Rodeo. I just learned about Table Plop this morning, and I think I probably had to recheck the spelling on it about three times to make sure I got it right. The Table Spire, which is entirely 3D, which I guess is unusual for this space a little bit. There's Tabletop Simulator, which is kind of a generic thing that's been around for quite a while. I guess there's Shard, which some people are pointing at. So, but it seems like that top three is stable, right? It seems like there's a lot. There's quite a bit of play in the space. But to I feel like if we'd said what are the top three VTTs, we would have said the same thing 5 years ago. If I'm not crazy about it.
And what I'm curious about is like the reason I was super excited about Vorpal Board was that it was kind of playing with AR a little, right? Like it was like, no, we're not going to, you know, yes, you can move tokens around on a grid, but also like just point your camera at the actual physical table and we'll overlay stuff, right? So I think I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I kept thinking like, well, I don't know, there must be, what kind of stuff was Sigil working on that was revolutionary, that was different from every other VTT that's out there right now, right? I mean, I think basically most VTTs boil down to like, a gridded map that you can move tokens around on, and rules automation. Is that basically what VTTs are?
I think, right? I think so.
Okay.
You know, maybe light on the rules automation. I think some people would say you're kind of assuming that the players themselves are adjudicating most of the rules, and then if we add some tools to assist them along the way, so be it.
I thought I remember, maybe I'm misremembering because it's been a while, but we had Toby on here talking about D20 Pro. We had a talk with him, and I swear I remember him talking a bunch about rules automation. Like that seems to me like the big win, especially as you get into crunchier games. Like, yes, I want, you know, the computer to take care of that stuff for me, so I don't have to like, you know, do a lot of math and, you know,
I think Toby with D20 Pro was leaning into that really hard to provide that extra support for folks. I think it makes sense as a roadmap if you're going to make a new VTT that's not the first thing you need. I need to show you a map. I need to show you tokens. That's my minimal viable product. And then I can add dice, and I can add, you know, a little bit like when you're playing with Martha the AI, right? You can get your initial instinct is to take control of a lot of that stuff as a test. And then if she shows you that she's competent and consistent with other stuff, then you can think about offloading more stuff.
It's interesting you bring up Martha, because here these are where my thoughts were starting to go. So, right, like when I play old school D&D mostly, right? So your fancy VTT that implements all of 5th edition isn't really a big sell for me, right? So if I'm playing virtually, my inclination is just to point the camera at board and move some miniatures around, right? Like I don't need a VTT or just use Theater of the Mind and great, all I need is video calling software. I don't need any of this stuff. But if I try to project what would be interesting, what would I want to see in a really fancy VTT, now I'm wondering where the AI plugins, right? Like when I play with Martha, right, one of the biggest problems with AI is rules adjudication. But what if the AI could talk to a machine a software that is doing rules automation, right? So then the AI is just playing DM and then, you know, telling the software, move this piece here, right? And then the software is making sure that the movement is correct, that the hit points are tracked right, that, you know, that the rolls are done right. And the AI is just the brain moving the bits around and creating the content. I feel like there's a huge win there. That feels to me.
I that seems coherent to me. Totally coherent to me. I mean, I'm reminded of the recent report that there's an AI playing chess that when the chess engine doesn't do what it wants, it goes hacks the chess engine to make make illegal moves suddenly legal for it or something like that. But that seems coherent. Or possibly, as we've talked about in the past, you know, having the AI, because what I thought Martha was great at was like dialogue. I thought was really sharp. you know, descriptions of monsters and things like that, I thought was really great. So I could also imagine it kicking in for, you know, particular dialogue with NPCs or things like that.
Yeah. That's what I would want, right? I would kind of want the AI totally separate from the rules automation virtual tabletop thing, right? So the AI is just calling API endpoints to say, generate this monster. Like, what are its stats, right? Make an attack roll. And like, you know, the AI can be hands-on. The AI doesn't have to track that stuff, right? Just make an attack roll and tell me the result. Virtual tabletop, great. Now I can narrate. I think that sounds super cool.
I think our recent experiments are that you need to remove the rules adjudications from the current style of LLM AI. And again, my personal analog is it's a very supportive improv performer, and it really wants to say yes and. You're probably going to have to remove that adjudication to deterministic engine.
If any of our viewers missed it, I did run a second session with Martha just yesterday, and that's exactly where we ended up, unfortunately, is she leaned heavily into kind of improvisational storytelling and kind of got stuck in a common theme that she was just repeating. And I was like, it just didn't have the excitement of that first session. There was no combat. There was no wacky hijinks. It was starting to feel a bit kludgy, honestly. So that's a thing I'll be working on with Martha in the future. But that's why my brain started thinking about, like, gosh, if Martha just had a rule system that was, you're right, right? So that's the problem. AI is non-deterministic, but rules adjudication of an RPG is deterministic, right? So you want the non-deterministic system to be talking to a deterministic system. I don't. It's interesting, very interesting. Right. So I kind of wonder. So that's where my brain goes, and then I start to wonder, like, oh gosh. Did the developers of Sigil not have an AI plan? Like, it seems like these days, if you're working in software, you better have a plan for how you're using and incorporating AI. And if you don't, you're behind the ball.
Now, one of the things that so among the signals we're getting about Project Sigil, on Rascal, I think the subheader, the subheadline to the article was lack of corporate interest and poor internal communication reportedly stymied success. Does that track with what we know about Wizards that poor internal communication? Does that track with what we know?
That sounds like a very apt description of the relationship between Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast to me.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds very apt. I was curious about this, Dan. I don't know if you were paying attention to the news prior to the layoffs and the it's canceled, but I feel like just a week or two ago, it was released, right? An early release of Sigil came out. Did you see any of those news reports?
I did not, actually.
Okay. I remember, and this is unfortunately, I don't have anything to quote here because I just remember scrolling through my newsfeed and seeing it and being like, huh, that's weird, that there was an early release and that it was not received very well, that it was very buggy, that players weren't super happy with it, and they were wondering why it was released at all, right? Like, what is the deal here? And this is not great, why, right? And in retrospect, I feel like this feels like a very a common pattern I've seen before, right? I can just imagine, you know, scuttlebutt in the office going around of, oh god, they're going to cancel us, what do we do? Push out what we have now. Push it out.
Yes.
Go.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Got it. That is a Got very it. Common pattern, and so I was not so, like, in retrospect I'm like, oh that's why it went out like that.
Got it.
You know, and I don't know where that comes from. Sometimes that comes from just a place of, like, I'm going to get laid off. I need something out there publicly that my resume can point at to show my work. Sometimes it comes from a place of, oh gosh, push it out now, and maybe, like, public will love it so much that there'll be demands, and then you know, corporate will be excited about the project again. A lot of different directions, but I've definitely seen a lot of that of, like, the nerves are like, oh gosh, the writing's on the wall for our project. It's now or never. It's go time. Shove what we have out, even if it's not ready.
Wow. That's a great insight. That I wouldn't have come up with myself. I don't think I've ever been at a place that did that. So that actually wasn't on my radar. Mm. What a great insight that is. Huh. Interesting. We need to get some income? Like, we need to show this gets some income? Is that ever part of it?
I've never seen that. No, usually it's more just about perception, whether it's perception of the public or perception of the owners, or again, just cases of, like, I saw this when 38 Studios went down, like, very quickly, a whole bunch of, like, stuff hit YouTube. And it was like a lot of, like, you know, we were holding everything very close to the vest. And then suddenly, like, here's a lot of information. Here's a lot of visuals of our game. And sure enough, all those unfortunately laid off artists are now linking those YouTube videos in their resumes, which, yeah. Yeah, you absolutely want that. You know, I've also seen like libraries get open sourced last minute, right? Like, yeah, I want to hang on to this code. It's good code. And we should open source it. Quick, open source this library.
Okay. Yeah. Oh. Wow, how fascinating is that? Wow. You know, one thing that I'm also a little, it's interesting because this before the Sigil thing came up, I was looking at some other software platform a couple days ago, and now I can't remember what it was. So another thing that I kind of have a little bit of scar tissue over is places that don't credit the developers. And Paul, the place where we worked at when I first landed there had a idiom whereby it's cool to not know who the developers are. So our policy is on our games, we don't release any credits. So it's a mystery, and we're like cool people working in the Matrix. You don't know who we are. And I'm like, you know, maybe if you are a founder, you're a vested founder, maybe you don't care. But as someone who's a frontline developer, that's my only calling card. And that changed while I was at that place. There was some other place, some platform I was investigating this past week, and like I get into it and I scroll a little bit down, and the credits only have first names. It's like, and big, you know, and our this was developed by Peter, Jack, Jill, Janet, Oscar, somebody else. And I'm like, I can't track down or credit who this was. And one thing I noticed is that with the Wizards Digital effort, I guess it was last summer, that someone that was previously at Wizards was pointing out that the Wizards Digital team working on Sigil and other stuff had been promised that they would be credited in the rule books, as it was sufficiently synthetic project. They were going to be credited in the rule books. Mm. Particularly rule book, like the digital rule books on D&D Beyond. And they were initially, and then their names were removed last July.
Fascinating.
Right? And I'm like, that is not a good sign. I do not like that when developer names get yanked off the credits. That just seems like a really bad flag to me.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, that kind of stuff, I feel like the only time that we see improvements on that are coming from external third-party groups, right? Like the big thing for video game credits to improve this is the IGDA, which is the International Game Developers Association, right? So they very clearly published guidelines for here is how you must format your credits, right? Mm-hmm. And lots of video game companies adopted this. And the nice thing is it became a way to not think about the problem. How do we format our credits? I don't know, just get the IGDA guidelines. Easy, easy peasy, done, right? And it's nice because it, you know, it's very clear about how and who and when and why to credit folks. I don't know. This is limited to the video game industry, and it's very fascinating that you're talking about like cross-crediting the rules development in print material. Right. That's so interesting. That's well outside of my realm of knowledge, but fascinating. Yeah.
Now, okay, so before we run out of time, let me pitch a couple of questions that I really want to get in here. So hypothetically, Hasbro comes to us Monday and they say, look, this didn't work. This one didn't work. That's on us. But we really want a virtual tabletop. We really want a D&D branded virtual tabletop. What's it going to take? And my first question is, should it be done in-house as Wizards, or should they hire a third party for it? Which is the more obvious choice to actually execute finally on a D&D VTT? I don't think I've ever seen this expression before.
Neither. lots of thoughts on this. And yeah, try not to get myself into too much hot water here. Neither is a good sign. If Wizards of the Coast came to us right now and said, Dan, Paul, you guys are software experts. Here's a big check. Please make us a virtual tabletop. My answer would be no, thank you. So I feel like in-house versus hiring a third party are both rife with problems for Wizards of the Coast. And I feel like the only success I can point at is D&D Beyond, which was conceived of and created outside of Wizards of the Coast and then acquired. So that's the answer, I feel like. They have to acquire a pre-existing product. Somebody else has to come up with the idea
to
make a better virtual tabletop, and then Wizards has to come in and buy it. I think that's your only road to success. And then, frankly, I don't know, what's that going to do to the end product once they're acquired? It might not be the best news. Like, maybe the best news for us as players is some third party comes up with an amazing virtual tabletop that just pushes the envelope and does incredible things. Mm-hmm. And in fact, here's the real success story. They license the IP from Wizards of the Coast. So therefore, your third party is paying Wizards money and everybody's happy with that. The end. That's the way to have success there, I think.
Well, I mean, doesn't that happen with like Roll 20? Isn't there some amount of, you know, you can access the D&D rules on Roll 20, if I'm not hallucinating. There's licensing fees that come back from that, I believe.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea, right? Yeah, I have no idea how they get access, right? Like, are they driving a Mack truck through the loophole of you can't copyright rules? Surely not. Like, they must have some kind of licensing deal with Wizards, right? So money must have changed hands somewhere. Even look at, like, I don't know, is it Foundry? Is Foundry there's some, I can't remember which one. There's at least one of the newer VTTs that was on my list that is very specifically a fifth edition VTT. And like, the only way that that exists is you've paid Wizards money, I think.
So I'm seeing that like next year is going to be the 10th anniversary of Roll 20 having a licensing deal to distribute licensed D&D content. So they've been connected for almost a decade in that way. So, and I feel like the last time we talked about this, my outrageous guess was that Wizards was saying, why don't we just scoop the whole thing? Why take a cut when we can just take everything? Was kind of my attempt at a stab at the psychology.
And there will be some people, right? Like I could totally see this. I can just predict this happening, right? Some small company makes a virtual tabletop, license the Wizards content. It's hugely successful. It pushes the envelope in some fascinating way, right? Incorporates an AI DM, let's say, just because I feel like I need some killer feature that's going to make it stand out from all the other VTTs, right? Make something that's super cool, right? It's amazing. It's super popular. It's done very well. And Wizards comes to that company and says, we're going to acquire you. Here is a big fat check. We want this in-house. And I could totally see the founders going, payday. Great. We did it. We made an awesome product. Yep. And now we're getting our payday for that. And they take the money and run. And the product then falls to bits.
Yeah.
Product's maybe cool for another year, maybe. And then it collapses.
Yeah.
That's...
Now, 100%. Okay, so that's what's going to happen. I'm not going to say 100% on that. I think that's absolutely the top option. I could also imagine, Paul, I'm going to throw in possibility number two. Mm-hmm. Someone's in that, like, my whole life, I love D&D, and I've always wanted to make this tool. I just this has been my dream job, and I'm going to stick it. I'm going to sell it great, and I have high aspirations. And I'm part of the actual D&D umbrella team, and I'm going to stick it out as long as I can to keep making the best project for the fans. I mean, I can see people that fundamentally love D&D enough that has been their life goal, and that they would want to stick with it for a longer time. I don't want to be the guy like Minecraft that regrets selling it, frankly.
That I feel like that love of the product, you know, whether we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons or Magic the Gathering, or you know, any other IP, that rabid fan of, oh my god, I got my dream job, I'm now at Wizards of the Coast, I love this product, I'm going to, you know, do everything I can to make amazing things for it. That, sadly, I think is the mentality of quite a few people over there. And I feel like they're willing to overlook a lot of issues with their employer for the sake of that. But it's D&D and I love it.
I think that's a great insight too. I mean, it's you know, it's dangerous to love so deeply sometimes.
I have one piece of advice that I give very freely to anyone in the workforce, especially in video game industry, because let's face it, there's a rose-tinted view of the video game industry. It's a cool job, right? So so a lot of people enter it and are willing to overlook less good qualities of their employer. Yeah. And my advice to them is always this: it'll never love you back.
That's great. I will say that my, you know, I frequently, as a computer science professor, I frequently have students in CS majors that are in their first year or two with me. And when at some point they find out that I've been in video games, and I'll have people that are very excited and like, how can I get into it? And I have, you know, my stab is it's very volatile. It's a very volatile job in my experience. Is you'll be at a place for a year, it'll be great. And then the next year it'll be disastrous. It'll be a huge roller coaster ride. Historically you have to move around a lot because companies only exist for a small number of years, 2 or 3 years, and they either get bought out or they're bankrupt. And you have to, so that's my opening stab, is you have to accept a very volatile existence. If that's what you're going to do.
And I'm sure it's not that different for, you know, tabletop games. In fact, I mean, like, the one thing I've heard about tabletop games is that it's really difficult to make a living at, right? Like, at least video games have a lot of money in them. The tabletop industry, less so.
Well, since forever, right, my analog has been that tabletop games compared to computer games are the same as theater compared to movies. And I'll just let you, anybody, as an exercise of the viewer, you can develop what the analogies are between those. Actors who are in movies, what they really love to do is they love to be live in the theater. And in my experience, most people that are working in computer games, what they really love to do is they love to do live over the table D&D. that's where their heart is, but to achieve a sufficient level of replicable media to bring in an income stream, you've got to do the reproducible thing.
Reasonable. Fascinating.
You know, one other thing here, I gotta get in. So Kilroy reminded me here of something that we saw, I think, in the Gizmodo article, is that one of the problems with Sigel that has been claimed is divisions in the executives at Hasbro is some people going, yeah, this is a D&D thing, and there's this whole subculture of virtual tabletops. And then other executives at Hasbro going, well, if you're doing this thing, why not make it more generic? And why not make it a generic platform that will support all of our various IPs at Hasbro, all of our toys and games and other things? And possibly that caused unclarity on the vision. Possibly that caused bloat on what they were trying, as they were trying to serve multiple purposes there. That seems coherent, right? That seems pretty believable to me. That would be a big problem.
I think it's very easy for anyone outside any company to look at that company from the outside looking for the yeah from the outside looking at it to say to assume that that company has some kind of uniformity of vision or purpose or direction. And that is rarely the case, and especially as the companies get bigger and bigger, right? This Wikipedia tells me that there's over 1,000 people working at Wizards of the Coast right now. I assure you, there's probably somewhere around 1,000 opinions at Wizards of the Coast about where a thing should go. and yeah, it would not surprise me at all. And even at the top level, and especially at the top level, that there's probably several executives who have very different views of where a given product should go. And that is a very difficult thing to navigate. And I think that's difficult to navigate at any company producing any product. And, you know, aligning on a vision is really hugely important and difficult to achieve when you have a very complex organizational structure.
Yeah, I see that. I see it a lot. Particularly, I mean, I just feel like, you know, D&D, the D&D culture is so passionate and so, you know, deeply thread into our lives, and we are not entirely normal people. And, you know, trying to synthesize that with a big corporate hegemony like Hasbro is, I'm sure that there are days of, you know, executives at Hasbro going, I have no idea what you're talking about. This was not covered in my master of business in any way. Having to deal with like semi-autistic crazy people talking about dice and fan and elves and stuff, I don't know how to interact with this, and I can see that being a big ongoing problem of how you interface with such an ingrained passionate community as we are.
Yeah.
We're prickly,
totally agree,
Paul.
But like the opposite isn't any better, right? The like, okay, well then we shouldn't have those people in our company. Our company should be run by the semi-autistic, crazy, passionate people. And then like look at what happened to TSR.
This has been the story since forever. You know, I gotta tell you know, I gotta point out that when we said we were gonna do this on our Discord server, there were a number of comments of you know, that third edition product actually did kind of look promising, and some of us did a bunch of first level characters, but people were also pointing out to the advanced D&D core rules that were released in 1996. So this is pre-Wizards. This is TSR producing this, and it's the second edition AD&D era. And for me, the UI is a little shaky, but this is actually a fully featured product. This does let you generate any character, monster, treasure, magic item, encounters, maps. It actually really does. It's a hyperlink, so you can make a map with encounters that checks to the rule. It has a complete copy of all the rule books at the time that's entirely hyperlinked involved. This actually is what Wizards has been promising since forever. I mean, D&D Beyond does a pretty good job with it, frankly. It does a pretty good job of it. Now, what I saw for a quote from the executive that that produced this back in 1996 is they lost money. So TSR, right, TSR managed to execute and lost money in doing so. So that's not good long term either.
Yeah. Yep. Dan, we're at time. Any I have to call us. Any final thoughts on Sigil? The Wizards of the Coast.
I mean, I could talk about this as you know. I could talk about this with you all day, Paul. We predicted this. This should not be an enormous surprise, because we absolutely predicted that probably they weren't going to be able to execute on this. Wizards has never been able to execute on a virtual tabletop, a virtual gameplay, and they're now at least three cycles into it, with third edition, fourth edition, now fifth edition, that they've crashed and burned. So I agree with your argument, Paul, that all signs are there is something endemic that it's impossible for them to do this. There's other great virtual tabletops out there that have been developed and battle tested for years. I have used Roll20 quite a bit in the past. If you're on Roll20, look for the official OED character sheet that is on Roll20. You can queue up our custom OED house rules there. Perfectly fine. And I'll also say, you know, we really feel for the people that got laid off this week. I bet that they're all fantastic people. I bet that they all love D&D, is probably why they were there. I bet they did do actual great work. If you have them in your network and they reach out to you, hire those people off Sigil. I bet they're top level professionals. Paul and I have both been in this situation before, and we wish them the best and land on your feet and hope you have an even better project coming up in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the project was announced, right, when they said, like, it's Dungeons & Dragons, virtual tabletop, and we're using video game development software, Unreal Engine, to make it, that ticked a lot of boxes for me. And it was, you know, I saw jobs come by with those listings and thought, I have those skills and I have that passion and I could do this job. And it was, you know, that would have been very enticing. It was very enticing. In various points over the last couple of years.
See that.
Yeah, so I absolutely feel for those folks. I'm sure they're absolutely heartbroken. And I hope their work is able to be used in some way in the future. But I feel for you folks. Viewers, if you have any thoughts on the state of virtual tabletops, Sigil in particular, or any of the current batch of virtual tabletops, especially curious about like what is going to be the next giant feature. I mean, it's easy to point at AI, but are there other huge things you think could like boost the next virtual tabletop into blowing up? I'd love to hear about that. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Please post us your thoughts here in the comments section of our YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will inspire a future episode of the show.
Absolutely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, TikTok, places like that. We have the handle Wandering and DMs on all those sites. So please boot up that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can get those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, we'll be there on our private Discord server. Every tier gets you access over there. And we'll be there on our private Discord server in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation in our live video after chat with our patrons. So if you're not a patron, go pitch a dollar into the kitty. And you'll get access to upcoming Dungeon Design Dash products that we release all the time, and also get to converse with you on Discord, where the conversation's happening 24/7 all the time. So we'll be both be there today. And let me see. Again, I hope everybody had a good time at GaryCon this year. Hopefully we'll be out there ourselves at some point in the future. And a lot of good stuff happened there. So don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you.